This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Ellen E. Jones about Screen Deep, how film and TV can solve racism and save the world. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
This is a brilliant book. This sounds like a terrible thing to say, but I read it basically in one sitting really quickly. It's so engaging, so interesting. There's basically like this rich treasure trove of loads of films I've seen, loads of films I haven't, loads of films I want to see afterwards. And they're kind of bound together by this genuine belief in, I think, the kind of power and importance of film and television. And I guess the place to start is kind of what motivated you or what inspired you to write the book.
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for saying that it's readable and that you enjoyed reading it, because that's really important to me. I really didn't want it to be like a sort of dirge of me finger wagging and telling people off for liking all the racist films and TV shows that they've liked since their childhood, because we all have them. So I'm really pleased to hear that. You know, I hope that my years of journalism have enabled me to write copy that's entertaining as well as informative. That was the goal. So yeah, thanks for saying that. I think what made me want to write it was a combination of, this had been my beat for a while in terms of writing about things that were happening at the intersection of like screen culture and race and racism. Quite a lot of stuff happens there, and we don't often discuss it with the kind of nuance and depth and sort of background knowledge that I think it deserves. So what I mean by that is that often these will be kind of little skirmishes on Twitter about, say, Danny Baker posting a picture of two monkeys and saying it refers to the royal wedding or something like that, or Whoopi Goldberg saying that the Holocaust, or saying that the Third Reich was kind of white on white violence or something like that. And then instead of using that as a jumping off point to go a bit deeper into what these people might mean by that or where they've gone wrong, we kind of just use it to tell people off on social media and then move very quickly on to the next scandal. So I wanted to go a bit deeper and also give some credit where it's due. And also it's partly my way of saying, you know, it's not me that's always banging on about race. Actually, this stuff is very intrinsic to particularly Hollywood cinema. From the very beginning, people have been making films about race, whether we acknowledge it or not.
I mean, it'd be good to know actually a little bit of that sort of, what would you call it, like the kind of history of race in Hollywood, because I mean it flows throughout the book really, and the book is both a kind of a rich education in the history of film and telly, and not just actually issues of race, but you know, things like gender inequality, class inequality, representations, I guess, more kind of generally. But where does race, I suppose, kind of figure in that history of Hollywood?
So yeah, as I say, when you talk about race today, particularly, you often, even if you just mention it casually, you get accused of always banging on about race. Or in fact, if you are a racialized person or a member of a racially marginalised group, you get accused of banging on about race, even if you don't talk about it at all. It just sort of goes with the territory, it seems. But in this case, I really want to point out that race has gone hand in hand with cinema since its very beginning. And what I mean by that is that Hollywood basically exists as a kind of, or began certainly as a kind of propaganda factory for this relatively new nation of United States of America. And many of the earliest films were Westerns, which were fairly explicitly pushing this kind of manifest destiny ideology, which would help prop up the rather flimsy legitimacy of a load of Europeans coming over to this landmass and colonizing it. And silent cinema in particular worked really well at that, because it was a way that people speaking different languages, coming from different European communities and moving to the sort of the cities on the eastern coast or the Midwest, could all kind of be unified in one space, hearing the same unifying story. And then a bit later on, around the time of D.W. Griffith and Birth of a Nation, 1915, which is still remembered both as perhaps the most racist film of all time, and often in a separate breath as an incredibly important seminal work of cinema, where cinema kind of went from being a novelty that you would do as a sort of diversion on the weekends and evenings to being a real art form, you know, a narrative storytelling form. That is both a very racist film and a very innovative film in ways that I don't think can be easily separated. And there's this funny thing where it seems like many of the big landmarks and milestones in the development of screen storytelling are also racist in some ways. So Birth of a Nation, then we go on to something like The Jazz Singer, which is famously the first talkie film and includes a lot of blackface. It's about a blackface minstrel act, Al Johnson's minstrel act. And then on to the first blockbuster, depending on how you count it, Gone with the Wind, which is obviously also this celebration of antebellum slavery and how great it was back then, before the slaves were freed. So I do think that there's this kind of relationship between cinema and television and race and racism and constructing racial identity, and particularly whiteness, constructing whiteness, that goes right back to the beginning of the film.
I mean, there's so much to kind of unpack in that history, and you've sort of touched on issues of representation. We'll probably talk about whiteness a bit later, various different kind of cinema genres, and the book, I think, goes through a variety of different genres in a really sort of an interesting and engaging way. And maybe we'll pick out sort of a few of them. We might talk about Westerns in particular a bit later, because as you've said, you know, they're so intrinsic to the kind of history of Hollywood. But I wonder maybe if we'll kind of like slightly come close to home in Britain and think about period dramas. Mm. So if we talk about the kind of history of Hollywood being intertwined with the history of race and racism, I think the same is probably true of that kind of like cliche of British television, which is that, you know, British high-end TV is about period dramas. And again, you know, you've mentioned social media, and we see lots of different kind of quite crude hot takes about who can and who can't be in period dramas. So why are they sort of, I guess, kind of an important case study in race and television, particularly in the British context?
I think period dramas help us really understand why this issue is important and should be important to everybody. And not just on the level of kind of, I'm a British TV exec and I don't want to be seen as racist or have to deal with lots of backlash on social media, so I better make sure I get a person of colour in my cast somewhere, you know, not on that level, but on a much deeper way that's meaningful and beneficial to all of us, whatever our specific racial identity. So there's a way of talking about the kind of whitewashing of period drama, which has historically been the case. So like Sense and Sensibility, let's say, won loads of Oscars, is directed by a Taiwanese man, Ang Lee, but is all white. And that's would be the case with pretty much all of the stories that we choose to tell about the past in Britain. And it's also a huge part of the British industry. They're very exportable. They're what American and English language audiences in other places of the world want to see, and non-English language audiences from our industry. So that means what goes in period dramas is very important to the industry. And often we see it as a problem of it being excluding actors of colour from having a career in their own home industry. And that has certainly been the case. So Idris Elba, Tandiwe Newton, I could go on and on and on and on naming Archie Punjabi, actors of colour who have been forced because of the period drama heavy nature of the British film industry and the whitewashed period drama heavy nature of the British film industry to go abroad, specifically to America usually, in order to have any kind of role beyond like Mugger number 3 on the bill or Casualty or what have you, or any kind of role that challenges them and is enough to establish them as stars. And then like in Idris Elba's case, they might come back again and work at home. Most people prefer to work close to home where their families are and in a culture that they understand. So often they will come home again once they've established themselves. But it's not just about that. I mean, if it were just that, it would still be worth diversifying period dramas. But it's also, I think, about the industry acknowledging the power it has to shape how we view the past. So I think there's this pretense that period dramas are mostly white because there's a honest attempt to tell the truth about the past, when actually it's reflective of decisions made in the present about what parts of history we want to talk about. Because obviously black people of colour didn't just pop up into existence in the mid-60s when the civil rights movement was going on, which is one of those stories from the past, including people of colour, that we like to tell. Or they didn't just exist only as enslaved Africans in the background, you know, in plantation scenes or sort of, you know, basically glorified set dressing in films like The African Queen or Zulu or so on. So so there are choices being made about what kinds of stories that we want to tell in the past, and that shapes our view of the past. Most people who don't have a higher level degree in history, where are they getting their ideas about what the past was like? They're getting it from TV and film. So when someone like Lawrence Fox tells us that he didn't like 1917, or he was enjoying 1917 until the Pakistani origin British actor Nabhan Rizwan turns up playing a Sikh soldier in a turban, because that disrupted his suspension of disbelief, because there weren't, according to him, there weren't any Indian soldiers in the First World War, when anyone who's bothered to pick up history books knows, in fact, there are about 2 million Indian soldiers in the First World War. Where does he get that idea from? He probably gets it from loads of other previous films about the First World War or TV shows about the First World War, which haven't bothered to include any characters of colour in, because it's not really about actual accuracy, historical accuracy, so much as it is about plausibility in the eyes of this constructed group of audience, which is assumed to be white, and not only assumed to be white, but often assumed to be a teensy bit racist as well. And I think when filmmakers give the audience a bit more credit than that, and also give themselves credit for their ability to shape what is plausible and perceived as accurate and real and true with their own filmmaking artistry, then they almost always end up making better films and better TV shows.
I mean, that analysis sort of extends into much more contemporary drama. So one of the later chapters does is try to say these constraints around particularly casting, but also actually around, you know, directors, mm. screenwriting, stories that get told, pin in particularly Black British creators. So you were saying about, you know, the assumptions of a particular kind of audience with a particular, I suppose, kind of, you know, view of the past. Mm. That audience is also assumed when we're talking about things like crime dramas, mm. particularly the pigeonholing and stereotyping. And how does that work? What are, I suppose, some examples of that, you know, possible stereotyping, but how have some of the key creators in the book kind of broken those industry expectations too?
I think there's like a sort of feedback loop when it comes to Black British creators and the kind of TV shows that they're allowed to make. So what I mean is that someone like Noel Clarke comes along and says, makes Kid Adulthood, which is actually fairly racially diverse, although all of the black characters live, are sort of depicted as more working class and kind of off the estate, and the white characters get to be a bit more middle class. But he makes this film, and then it's very successful. And then that kind of seems to support his argument that he is the representative of young black working class Britain, of people of colour, and therefore he kind of gets to make more films, more of the same. Whereas I would argue that a film like that is successful not necessarily by virtue of it being particularly accurate, certainly not accurate to all people of colour in Britain or all black Britons, because, you know, it's not a monolith. There's a lot of diversity within that demographic. But because it's an example of the scarcity of representation, and when there's so little of you, and that might be just working class teenagers in general very rarely get to see their point of view on screen, or when it's not kind of mediated through a much older or kind of, you know, person of a different demographic, or in this case black people of color, that you're so hungry for that representation that you'll take whatever crumbs come your way. And then I think the industry, which again often is, you know, is the decision makers still are predominantly white and middle class, they will misinterpret that as a sign of it being authentic representation, and therefore commission more and more of it. And that's what sort of becomes its kind of negative feedback loop. But I think the context is really important when we're critiquing shows for furthering stereotypes, racial stereotypes, because a lot of, especially comedy or genre television and film, does traffic in stereotypes of one kind or another, racial stereotypes, gender stereotypes, just sort of cultural stereotypes. It's kind of can kind of be an easy, quick hand in these sort of lighter entertainment forms that aren't pretending to go any deeper than that. But the problem is when that's all there is for one particular group, when the only representation of young black men is drug dealers, and there's no kind of diversity within that on television, on mainstream television, that's when it becomes problematic. So whereas obviously there are infinite depictions of what it means to be a young white man on television, or, you know, a white man in general. So something like Top Boy, which is a show that I'm a big fan of, actually, especially in the way that it's kind of evolved over its runtime to be more expansive of different kinds of experiences and different characters, and I think it's just really well written, compelling, dramatic television. But a show like that, it would be fine to make, you know, a show like The Sopranos about a white guy who's a gangster and drug dealer. It's essentially a gangster rise and fall story, but it does get a lot of criticism for stereotyping black men, and I think a lot of that is down to the fact that there just isn't. It was just for a long time the only really popular depiction of black people with a kind of black majority cast on television at all, in British television. So that meant that there was a kind of unfair burden of representation on its shoulders. And once that burden is spread out a bit more evenly, and you get things like I May Destroy You by Michaela Cole, or there's this show called Riches, which is about a kind of very wealthy, posh black family, or, you know, there's a couple more interesting, or Dreaming Whilst Black, like lots of more interesting shows that have been coming up in recent years, then the sort of the pressure on Top Boy to be good representation in the sense of positive, successful representation no longer exists, and everything can just exist and be free as it is.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
We talked about, I suppose, like two quite kind of high-end quality TV genres there. I wonder if we might talk about a genre that some people, for example, Martin Scorsese, have derided as being very like kind of like low sort of brow, or I can't remember what the exact Scorsese quote is about like superhero.
He said they're like, not. Whatever. It's not cinema. It's a fairground ride, or it's a theme park.
Yeah, that's
theme park attraction, something like that.
Carnival fairground sort of spectacle. And one of the things the book tries to do, I think, really, really well, is say, look, you know, some things around the superhero genre really work. Some things really don't. And this is this will be like the 100th time someone has made this pun to you. But, you know, there are heroes and villains involved. And I'm intrigued to hear your take on the genre, partially because we've been talking about what we might think of as, you know, quite quality high-end telly in the British context. Also because, you know, this is like, they make billions of dollars, they're popular all over the world, you know, that they are a genre that I think we need to engage with when we're thinking about race.
I should say before I answer this question that since I wrote that chapter, I've become even more bored with superhero movies and even more ready for this chapter in our cultural history to be done with. I think they're totally at saturation point. But that's kind of part of the point, though, is that especially like for the last, let's say, 20 years, 25 years, particularly Marvel, the Marvel Cinematic Universe has just been so dominant in our culture. Like a movie star can't get on the highest paid list unless they've got, you know, a Marvel character that they're playing in repeated movies in their back pocket, or you know, they're on this. There's some kind of iteration of an MCU product, and product is the word, in our cinemas or on our TV screens constantly, and something else new being trailed, and so on and so on and so on. So it's quite monocultural, basically, and that's part of the sort of underlying point of the book is that monocultural leads to bad, boring cinema, and that the more diversity there is in all senses, it's better for everyone. We just end up with more originality and better screen storytelling and better films for us to go and watch, and we should all want that. So like I'm bored, but because it's so dominant, such a dominant culture, it matters who is represented in these films. Like it matters who is the kind of hero, the epitome of the greatness of humanity, how that is represented. And for a long time, all the superheroes, your Batmans, your Superman, your Captain America, so on, were all these very upright, upstanding white men, American men specifically, whose kind of moral rectitude was represented by their physical uprightness and upstandingness and muscly bods and so on. So it was incredibly powerful when in 2018 Black Panther came along and demonstrated that there could be a really, really African, really black superhero who explored the kind of connections between the diaspora and differences in black liberation politics, and really went there in terms of Killmonger, the sort of villain, if you like, although he's much more complicated than that. You can't easily dismiss him as just a villain. And also like rooted Black Panther in this, which is actually just a kind of, according to Stan Lee anyway, a coincidence that Black Panther is called Black Panther, and at the same time there's this black liberationist group called the Black Panthers rising. But Black Panther kind of brings these two things together and sort of shows him rooted in this Oakland-based community outreach activity, which the Black Panthers were. So it's like, and then most importantly, it kind of explodes all box office records and ought to have finally put paid to this notion that black stars, black stories, black directors, black writers can't open a film at the box office, by which I mean make a lot of money at the box office, that these things are sort of niche interest only to a small amount of people. So it was given that the whole industry kind of revolves around the economics of the superhero movie at the moment, as I say, I'm hoping that's kind of coming to an end, but given that it's it was very important that Black Panther came out, and that there have been other kind of like the Ten Rings film, I've forgotten the full title, one with Simu Liu, came out, and there've been other kinds of, like, there's been a concerted effort at the MCU to sort of diversify, and it has borne some fruit. But at the same time, it's done this sort of kind of horrible thing of, like, incorporating any interesting up and coming directors. Ryan Coogler was an example of that. I think he might be one of the few examples where he actually put his own mark on it as well and didn't just get steamrolled by the MCU machine. But, like, I sort of, my heart breaks for, like, Chloe Zhang, the director of Nomadland, which is a film I really liked, who then ends up making The Eternals, which is a film that I found quite, well, maybe not boring is not the right word, but it certainly had its boring parts. And it just felt like it wasn't her voice coming through anymore, which is presumably why they wanted her in there in the first place. It's kind of a necessary evil at the moment, I think, for us to get our heads around. And there are ways of using the superhero narrative to explore race and racial identity and racial oppression in really interesting ways. And not, I mean, it should be noted that the comic books themselves derive from a reaction to anti-Semitism, I'll say, in a very similar way to Hollywood's founding by basically a group of mostly working class or like self-made first or second generation Eastern European Jewish immigrants on the East Coast who were barred from making their way in other professions because of anti-Semitism and then decided to kind of build this thing on their own. That's the story of the beginning of Hollywood, and that's also the story of the comic books. And you can see that if you choose to see that reflected in the characters themselves. I've seen it suggested that Superman is a kind of Moses in that he's leaving his home planet in a kind of spaceship put by his parents as the sort of last survivor of his people. And also they have these kind of their fake identities that are comparable to the way a lot of Jewish men and women would have to change their names to a less Jewish sounding name to avoid anti-Semitic discrimination. So it's right there inbuilt in the nature of the genre is this kind of resistance to white supremacy and this sense of awareness of these kind of dynamics in the world. And then you see things like Watchmen, the Damien Lindelof TV show, or Black Lightning did really interesting stuff on race. Like in Black Lightning, his powers derive from his sort of repressed anger at the racism that he encounters all the time. And I think I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I think it's like a racist police officer that eventually sets him off, and then lightning starts shooting from his hands, and he has his Black Lightning powers. So there is interesting stuff to be done there. Also, like the whole kind of theme of vigilantism, which is a big theme of the superhero genre. And when is it all right, if the state doesn't protect you, when is it all right to take protection of yourself and your community into your own hands? Like that question is interestingly complicated by a racial element, by the history of Black Americans in America, certainly. There's interesting stuff there. I just think Marvel's done a real number on us by just totally oversaturating everything. And I think I'm not the only person who's thoroughly bored of it all by now.
You mentioned whiteness and white supremacy when we were thinking about superheroes and the kind of complexity of that with stuff like, things like Superman and then the original, the Marvel characters and stuff like this. And later on in the book, you really kind of get to grips with whiteness. Through two filmmakers, and if you've talked about your sort of boredom with superhero films, I might reveal my own boredom with Wes Anderson movies.
Did you like them in the beginning?
I did actually, yeah. And then, you know, when you've seen one, you've seen one. And one of the things that I think is great actually about both the Anderson and Sofia Coppola's films that you discuss as well is you really get to grips with, I guess, the kind of broader issue around whiteness in cinema, which is really kind of its absence, the absence of talking about it, the absence of the idea of there being kind of like white films for white people, as opposed to, as we've already talked about, you know, the really kind of open language from studio execs, producers, commissioners about the black audience and black filmmakers and stuff like this. And I'm sort of interested to know, I mean, maybe let's not like pile in on Wes Anderson's like mini genre. Mm. But, you know, and again, you talk in the book actually about how people react when you raise questions of whiteness, which is absolutely fascinating in of itself. But yeah, where is sort of whiteness in the story, and why do these particular filmmakers I think show us the kind of problem of whiteness in cinema?
I think what kind of my starting point was, because I'd seen people talk about Wes Anderson's films as white, and maybe less so Sofia Coppola's, but also a little bit, and I kind of wanted to really like get to the bottom of that. What does it actually mean when we say a film is really white or a filmmaker is really white, you know, beyond their obvious racial identity, which is not narrowing it down at all, because there's a lot of white filmmakers about. But like, how do we, what are we really talking about? Because it wasn't the most obvious answer to that. And sometimes people think this is what the criticism is. Is that the casts aren't diverse enough, or that they never employ people of colour. And in Wes Anderson's case, that simply isn't true. He does have actors of colour, particularly in his latest film. I do wonder if he's kind of reacting to some criticism. But, like, I mean, you know, in the Darjeeling Limited, which is a film about three white American brothers visiting India, obviously it's set in India, so there's background characters, and Irfan Khan has, I hope I've got his name right, so you'll have to cut that out if not. He's got a kind of short, small role in the film, the very revered Indian actor. And, you know, Danny Glover's in Royal Tenenbaums, and Tony Revolori is in Grand Budapest Hotel, and so on. So they are people of colour in his film. So it wasn't that, and it was trying to kind of get at what it was. And where I really arrived at was that there's nothing so white, this is kind of the central irony of it, there's nothing so white as avoiding making a film about race at all. Like the avoiding talking about whiteness and naming it is about the whitest thing you can do as a filmmaker, sort of sidestepping it delicately. And I think what makes Wes Anderson and Sofia Coppola's films the kind of epitome of that is actually a compliment to their filmmaking, which is the elegance and deliberation with which they sidestep questions of race. and again, never, without ever actually kind of naming it. So like Sofia Coppola's worlds, for instance, have so carefully controlled in order to deliver this kind of feeling of luxuriating in softness and femininity, and they're all about girlhood. And they concentrate on girls' lives, white girls' lives very specifically, but in a way that I think is very exciting for a lot of female viewers, because that group has also been underrepresented, and their interior lives, interiority has been kind of underexplored in film. And something like The Virgin Suicides, which is a film I really admire, does do kind of interesting things about sort of reversing the male gaze and so on. But it seems like, and she's explicitly said this, that she seems unable to deal with gender when it's complicated by race in any way. So with The Beguiled, she's deliberately exercised all the characters of colour, the black women characters that exist in the original book and also in the 1970s adaptation of the book. And she said, and when asked why she'd done that, she said, because she wanted to tell a story about gender, which obviously begs the question, are black women not women? Because that's the sort of implication of that statement. Not a conscious one, I suspect, but anyway. It kind of became interesting to talk about what the quality of whiteness in films is and how it exists in this kind of denial, because the whitest thing, again, that you can do is to sort of not understand yourself as white, because you're just a sort of human, no qualification needed. You're just experiencing the universal human experience, and that racialization is something that only racialized groups experience or is necessary. So, you know, I say in the book, if you want to kind of make a white person feel really uncomfortable, you just have to call them white, because that experience of being racialized isn't something that white people or white filmmakers, speaking more specifically to our topic, experience much. And I think in terms of like the final push, or the like what needs to happen, maybe not the final, but what needs to happen next in terms of how we make films and television about race and how we think about race on screen, is that we do need to kind of develop language and a confidence to talk about whiteness so that it can be dethroned or decentralized properly from this kind of position it has of being the universal human experience, which is a real position of power, cultural power to being on the same level as every other racial identity.
I might carry on that sort of thought, actually, that sense of, well, what do we need to do? Because, you know, the book has got this pretty kind of ambitious title, actually. Yeah. And maybe, you know, one that people might not associate with film, the idea that, like, literally film and TV can solve racism and save the world. And that last chapter really sort of kind of reinforce that sense that, that you've got of your, I guess, kind of like faith in film and telly. And you talk about three ways around empathy, showing structural racism, showing the kind of the sense of race being a construct. And crucially, actually, the kind of fourth way, which is like basically the last line in the book, which is like audiences kind of have to step up a bit as well, which I really like and I was really, really drawn to. And it'd be good to hear, I guess, you know, what are the sort of the ways that film and TV can kind of deliver on that promise?
Well, I think a lot of it is about disseminating a kind of, I guess it's a more complex idea of race and racism than the sort of colloquial one that we have. Because I think once people understand, and by that I mean race as a construct, a social construct that's kind of historically, politically determined, because once we understand that race and racial categories were invented, then we understand that they can be deconstructed and taken apart as well. And that, you know, that brings with it a bit of hope, I think, for this is not something that's necessarily intrinsic to human existence, sometimes it gets talked about that we're all kind of inherently racist. I think you could probably make a case that we're all suspicious of difference and others, and that's kind of rooted in our past as a species, but that's not the same thing as racism necessarily. And I mean that by talking about racism in terms of the way it's embedded into the structures of our society and our institutions and so on. So I think TV and film, by kind of pointing out, both in quite literal ways, like making period dramas about colonialism, which speaks the truth of it rather than kind of peddling the manifest destiny thing all over again, that like examine how whiteness has historically been constructed and the evil that's been done in its name. So like something like Killers of the Flower Moon, I think, is really interesting on that, as to take an example of a recent film. So cinema and TV can do it in that way, but also in more subtle ways that actually use the technicalities and the artistry of the medium. So I'm thinking about a film like Passing, which is by Rebecca Hall, and it's filmed in black and white, and the kind of flattening effects of the black and white image enables us to see these two characters, one of whom is racialized as white, one of whom is racialized as black, and yet they have the same skin tone. In fact, they both grew up in the same area, and they're both mixed race women, what we would call in our, you know, 2020s London terminology, mixed race. But one is passing as white in order to fulfill her own personal ambitions, and because she's married to a very racist white man, that's the one played by Ruth Negger, and the other one, played by Tessa Thompson, is living in a kind of quite upper middle class black society, surrounded by black people and working for like the anti-racist organizations, but has a lot of quite interesting classism and even some sort of colorism internalized, which the film also explores. And because of the nature of the photography, it flattens that image of these two women side by side, and it forces us to ask, why is one of these women black and one of these women white when their skin tones on black and white camera look exactly the same? So it sort of draws our attention to those things in a really interesting way. So I've kind of lost myself a little bit, but perhaps you can draw me back.
So that's like one of the promises that, you know, cinema can kind of film and telly rather than just cinema can deliver on. And, you know, it also is one of the ways that you can, you know, show structural racism, that sense of race as a construct. That I wonder about, I mean, expanded empathy is in there as well, with the example of passing, but I wonder if you could tease out another of the kind of empathy examples before we sort of like have a go at the audience for not being demanding enough.
Well, I think like we often talk about representation in terms of if I can see it, I can be it. So that's the idea that like little kids from underrepresented racial backgrounds need to see people who look like them succeeding on screen or living out interesting, fulfilled lives, and that will give them the confidence and the kind of map to build that for themselves. And I think there's lots of truth in that. But I also think we need to kind of expand that idea of what good representation means and why it's good to include sort of 3D humanity. So let's not confuse good representation with good character, for instance. Like we need to see the full humanity of different racial groups on screen, and not just for the people in those racial groups depicted, but because cinema, those of us who are in underrepresented groups have had grown up going to the pictures or watching television and always, almost always exercising that empathy muscle, because we'll see characters who look nothing like us from backgrounds nothing like ours, and we will find points to empathize with them because, you know, that's what good storytelling enables us to do. And we are in that way living out the fullest potential of the medium. And I also say I like that. I'd like that also for white men, for middle class white men or posh white men, to also have those same opportunities to put themselves in the shoes of people whose lives are very different from themselves, and expand their empathies that way and expand their horizons that way and have their minds blown that way, because it's incredible. It's like, it's what the movies are there for. So I think the representation is important in that way too, and that kind of empathy expanding is good. I mean, I talk about, there's two different kinds of empathy that film and TV can help us with. One is that where we talk about putting yourselves in the shoes of someone who's very different from ourselves. The other is one that's been traditionally closed off to, has been traditionally afforded to white people and closed off to everyone else. And that's the kind of ability to live out extreme situations, but from a position of physical safety. So like in horror films, which sometimes have people of color in them, or monsters that were racialized in a way as though to depict people of color, but the person being scared, the person having that empathy, you know, inducing extreme situation from the experience, was always a white person. And in recent years we've seen filmmakers like Jordan Peele and Remy Weeks with His House, and other filmmakers who got interested in horror genre kind of expanding that territory or reclaiming that territory for people of color, so that they can also experience that kind of empathy building, which is slightly different from the other one that we were talking about.
It's good you mentioned horror, because one of the places to kind of wrap up is the sense of what we could have talked about. There were so many other genres. There's, you know, big long discussion about westerns, particularly westerns that I now want to go and see, basically kind of indigenous filmmakers sort of reclaiming almost the western genre. There's like lots of stuff around kind of romance, whether that's like what you might think of as formal romance films, but also like buddy movies. There's still about sci-fi in there, kind of TV sitcoms. That there's, you know, such a kind of rich depth of coverage of film and telly, of kind of screen in general. And it seems, I guess, kind of a bit mean to conclude with, you know, now you've done this brilliant book, what else are you going to be doing? But it sort of strikes me that the book has got a blueprint for a lot of campaigning, a blueprint for getting people to kind of think differently about cinema. You know, we've mentioned the audience a couple of times. You know, it's a book that really kind of almost is a sort of like call to arms for an audience to demand better from our kind of commissioners, editors, producers, etc. And, you know, you work as a journalist, you talked about, you know, the film beat. So are you going to be kind of continuing in this space, or are you thinking of, you know, is there a sort of different book, a different take you might want to write about, maybe, you know, not cinema, maybe not race, or are you thinking there's possibly a sequel here as well?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I'm enjoying talking about this. Like, I thought that this subject and this book, and one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to kind of lubricate these conversations and make them more possible and make people feel that they could. Because look, what stops people talking about race, right, is fear of causing offence, or, you know, when they don't meet you, which is quite a sweet place that a lot of people, I think, are coming from. But it has kind of terrible consequences because it means we never actually address, you know, even really begin to describe the problem properly, because we're all so scared of being called racist, or, you know, or yeah, being called racist, basically, that it has this absurd consequence that we're more scared of being called racist than of actually continuing to unknowingly or unthinkingly perpetuate actual racism, which causes real world harm. So I'm happy to keep talking about this, and it's so rich. I mean, one of the side effects of like these decades of racism within the film and TV industry is that there's so much talent and really cool, interesting films that have just been overlooked and haven't been celebrated the way they deserve to be celebrated. Like, I've been talking a lot recently about an actor called Frank Silvera, who was this sort of interestingly racially ambiguous Jamaican born guy with a Sephardic Jewish dad, who may or may not have participated in the first on-screen interracial kiss in Stanley Kubrick's second film, Killer's Kiss, and was just this incredible guy and just never really got celebrated the way he deserves to for his incredible talent, because, you know, mostly because of sort of racial things and sort of industry racism. So there's lots to talk about here, and I am very, very happy to continue to talk about it. And we'll see what happens next.